Hello, and welcome to Voices from the SBS Summit, brought to you by the National Insider Threat Task Force. My name is Dr. Jennifer Dewey, and I oversee a variety of projects for the Threat Lab. Today, Dr. Adam Trexler and I are continuing the conversation we started back in September during the Counter Insider Threat Social and Behavioral Sciences Summit. Hi, Adam. How have you been since we last talked?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on today, and I'm excited to get into a little bit more detail and talk more about this exciting topic.
I hope that all of our listeners have watched the recording of your webcast on lessons learned on detecting and mitigating bias in the Counter Insider Threat space, and this is available on sbssummit.com. But for those who have not, would you mind telling us a bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Sure. Like you said earlier, my name's Adam Trexler, and I'm a data scientist with Elder Research. We do a lot of consulting work for customers in the defense and intelligence sector, and I've been doing that for the last 5 or 6 years now. What that means is we basically bring data-driven solutions and analytics to customers and really try to help them solve some of the hardest problems that they have as organizations. And so through that work, I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of organizations specifically on counter insider threat. And that's what I'll be excited to talk about today.
So in your summit presentation, you talked about biases such as human cognitive biases, cultural biases, and statistical biases. And then you also talked about strategies to mitigate those biases. So let's pick up where we left off. And let me ask you, kind of between the cognitive, the cultural, and the statistical biases, what type of bias tends to come up most in your research?
We really see examples of all of these throughout our work with organizations in the counter insider threat space. Coming from a data science and machine learning perspective myself, I sort of have my hands and eyeballs on the statistical bias most because that's the kind of thing I'm looking for in the data work that I do on a day-to-day basis. But certainly we see lots of examples of cognitive bias at play in this space and many others, and also cultural biases. And some of those I talked about during my summit presentation. One thing I've noticed is there's a big desire or a trend, I would say, recently to use data and analytics to help mitigate some of these biases, and these inevitably crop up. That's not to say that like data and data science are a silver bullet. Obviously, modeling and analytics can all have their own biases, and there are a lot of well-documented examples of that. You know, models are only as good as the data that they're trained on and built with. And so if that data has bias inherent in it, then that bias is going to be expressed in the model itself. There are a couple strategies we can use to cope with those kind of problems, though, those kinds of issues. One is just being really intentional about building models and analytics to help in this space. So like I said, a model is only going to be as good as data that was used to build it. But if you document and understand how that model uses that data, that at least gives you not the opportunity to remove the bias, so to speak, but at least uncover the bias and be able to understand how and when that's being applied. So you can see examples of these kind of biases and issues with data have cropped up a lot in when analytics and data have been used to predict things like recidivism and whether parole should be granted and things like that. Another trend in data science has been towards more explainable models. And so again, this kind of goes back to all models are going to be biased if the data that they're built with is biased. But if we understand how the model works, and we then know the model will be applied consistently across populations, we can help to uncover when and where that bias is being applied. And I think there's a lot of very active work and interest in ensuring that the use of data and analytics and modeling is more equitable and responsible. And that's something that we've seen a lot of our clients asking and talking more about.
It seems that a trend or perhaps a practice that is built into your work is really transparency in terms of acknowledging that your model might not be perfect, that it does have bias, but being incredibly transparent and making sure that not only are you aware of it, but the other folks that you're working with are aware of it, your clients are aware of it.
Absolutely. I think that's incredibly important. And like I said, being able to understand why a model is producing the output that it's producing is key in a lot of these cases. You know, there are a lot of models, often ones that get a lot of media attention that perform really effectively, but are really a black box. You don't know what happened to the data from going into the model to producing an output. However, there are a lot of models that are not like that, that are designed in ways that you can understand how they manipulate data and use data and then produce an output that they might produce. And so understanding the inner workings of the model based on making intentional choices about the kinds of models and the kinds of analytics you use, I think that's really important to bring that transparency. And also just, I think where you're talking about bias, I think it's important not to be too biased or have preconceived notions about how great analytics or models are going to be, right? Like you pointed out, being transparent that these models aren't going to be a silver bullet, I think is very important too.
There are a lot of case studies of insider threat that discuss how insider threat actions were not out of the blue. An employee did not just wake up one day and suddenly decide to commit an act of violence or do other types of harm to their organization's resources. There were signals and signs along the way. Given that, when is bias most likely to happen? Or is that a way to think about it? Is bias more likely to happen at the beginning, such as when it's part of the hiring process? Does it happen at the end when supervisors or investigators might still be questioning the evidence? Or does bias happen somewhere in the middle as things that an employee says or does start to pile up?
I agree. It's not something that happens out of the blue. And I think bias can certainly have an impact at any stage of the process and really all those different kinds of bias that we talked about. So one thing that we've used a lot in our work and many others in the insider threat field is that critical path model that developed by Shawn Sellers a few years ago to understand and produce, kind of provide a framework for understanding someone's progression from a trusted insider to an insider threat, right? Everyone starts with a set of personal predispositions and stressors are applied to everyone, right? People react in different ways to them. And that may, in some folks, under some circumstances, start being manifested in terms of concerning behaviors and things like that. And that's as a person moves down that critical path. And there are opportunities along that critical path, right, that organizations, supervisors, managers, peers can shift people off a critical path or actually produce maladaptive responses where an organization might actually unintentionally push someone further down that critical path until, you know, someone actually becomes a more active insider threat. So that's the framework that we've used a lot to understand this phenomenon. And not, like I said, bias, it happens at every stage. So I think in the beginning, it's going back to thinking about stressors being applied to individuals. Everyone experiences stress in their life at various stages of their life, right? And I think it's one area there where bias can creep in is it's really difficult at that stage to determine what is signal and what is noise, right? Like what is normal life stresses that someone is experiencing that might be just transient versus a stressor that is going to end up producing concerning behaviors and pushing people further down that critical path. I think that's where bias can creep in because it's, by its very definition, it's coloring your perceptions of what someone might be going through, right? We've also definitely seen more of a cultural bias can creep in towards the end when the organization is trying to respond to concerning behaviors that individuals are exhibiting. And that's where if there's a cultural mentality of like getting the bad guy or something like that, then that can definitely produce maladaptive responses and actually exacerbate the problem. And instead of pushing people off the insider threat path, right? One thing that we always try to keep in mind is that insiders are people and they are the organization's greatest asset. And so I think that's a place where cultural biases can definitely produce poor outcomes.
What you just said resonates with me a lot because I think we all are undergoing a lot of stress. I think particularly in the past couple of years with COVID-19, everyone sort of moved, many, many employees moving toward a telework arrangement, which may work better for some employees than others. And then I think a lot of other stressors that are happening because of that, with schools being closed, but then they're open, but then they're closed again, and the same, you know, and the same with daycare. I think that issue of really very much in the early part of the model, determining what's true stress and what is constituting noise is super important because we all have versions of our own bad day. A client meeting didn't go very well, but then something might also be happening at home. And so I agree. It's really, really important to really try and understand and determine when does an organization need to take action because something really is truly concerning, or when is it just an employee having a difficult time during that day and they'll come back tomorrow and things will be on a more even keel. Something else that's kind of related to this is that an employee may work at an organization for a long period of time. They may interact with a substantial number of colleagues, supervisors, as they and others travel. both within the organization and in and out of the organization. You end up with situations where threat may start to be identified, but a key employee that voices a complaint perhaps is promoted to another group, or maybe a supervisor that had a very close relationship with that employee of concern retires and leaves the company. So that momentum of identifying these concerning behaviors slows down, or perhaps it stops completely. Can you talk a little bit about how biases factor into these situations, and do the same kinds of mitigation strategies apply?
Sure. Yeah, that's certainly what you just described. I think, yeah, we've seen examples of that in our work in my organization. And also, yeah, as you described, there are a few kind of landmark case studies of insider threat where this kind of circumstance led to threats not being identified soon enough, right? And so one thing I think is important that we like to stress here is I think it's important to have a unified and sort of holistic framework across organizations wherever possible to collect data and keep data associated with individuals throughout their time in an organization. So I think that can be challenging in large organizations, obviously, but I think having sort of that unified whole organization approach to associating data with individuals, I think can be really important within that framework too. I think starting to think then about bias and how someone's experience may change as they move through an organization and through their career, I think it's important that while you collect that unified data-driven picture of an individual, you want to always be sort of using that data and analyzing that data in a very relative way with respect to where that person is in the organization, in their career, and things like that. And by that, I mean, we want to analyze and look at people in context of what kind of job they might have and peers that have that same job, or just like where they sit, who they interact with on a day-to-day basis, right? I think having those contextual factors is really important to understanding where someone may be in that insider threat critical pathway. For example, right, like in some organizations, right, like there may be higher levels of stress at different times of the year, right? Like the example that I like to give is the accountants and tax professionals within a large organization. Like during tax filing season, that's going to be a stressful time of year. That's going to be a stressful few months. And so it's important that from a sort of insider threat mitigation perspective, to keep that in mind, right? That when we're looking at individuals within that organization, you know, everybody there is probably going to be experiencing a higher level of stress for a few months. And so we need to kind of be looking at them relative to one another and not relative to, you know, another job category, another part of the organization that might be in a lower level of stress just based on their job responsibilities.
I'm thinking of other situations as well. There might be organizations experiencing layoffs. And so everybody might be going through a period of stress, wondering who will be pink slipped and who will retain their position. Organizations also change, I think, their processes and procedures a lot as well. So there always seems to be a little bit of underlying stress in terms of trying to keep up with how an organization is functioning and what they're doing and how you need to react in terms of updating your own information or reacting to their various processes so that you can continue to do their job and the organization can continue to function well.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And going back to something you said earlier, just thinking about the last few years during the pandemic, I mean, that's another example of a change that society has gone through, right? And everyone, I think, across the board has experienced a higher level of stress at some point during this pandemic. And so if I'm building a model to determine insider threat risk and using that model and looking at people 5 years ago versus 1 year ago, everybody 1 year ago is going to be at a higher stress level. But that obviously doesn't mean that the incidence of insider threat has dramatically shifted or anything like that. So yeah, keeping those contextual factors very involved, I think, is important.
You know, over the course of the past couple of years, I think that stress level seems to be so elastic, where there may be some days where the stress is not so bad, but then other days where somebody's child's school may have closed or the daycare may have closed because of COVID cases, or they may have actually, I think, be experiencing COVID, or perhaps a member of their family is. So the elasticity of stress, I think, in regard to people's days quite a bit has been quite prevalent, I think, over the past couple of years. And it will be interesting to see as we continue to work our way through this pandemic, how it continues to play out in the workplace, realizing too that the workplace is not just confined to an office anymore, but it is expanded to people's homes as well.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, you raised another good point, which is, yeah, thinking about how work has been changing over the last couple of years. And I think to many observers and folks in the workforce, I think work will just be different moving forward. The sort of nature and shape of the workplace hasn't changed so much. You're totally right that the sort of the elasticity, the variability of stress load is definitely higher, I would say. Yeah.
Something that I think strikes me as well is that whenever we talk about bias, it always seems to have a negative connotation. Bias is often perceived as negative. We're being biased for something or biased against something, and that never sounds good. But are there ways in which bias can be positive?
Yeah, I think so. I think sort of two things I could say to this. One is, you know, this is not something I got into in my talk because I didn't want to necessarily introduce yet another definition or type of bias. But in machine learning and data science, we talk about the bias of a model as actually being the set of assumptions and sort of the systematic way that a model is going to be wrong about reality, because you have to make a set of assumptions to simplify reality, which is very messy, into something that's more mathematically tractable and actually able to be modeled with a, you know, a machine learning model, right? So that makes the model inherently wrong, but it makes it possible to actually do something. And so there's that old saying in statistics, you know, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And that's totally true. I think as long as we keep in mind that our models are not reality, not even close, but they can tell us something useful about reality if we use them in a careful way. I think that's really important. To me, that's one way that bias, in that sense of defining it as how a model is going to be systematically wrong, can actually be beneficial, because it gives us a tool, which is that model, to understand what's happening in reality. And another sort of second thing I would say about sort of a positive bias is thinking more about cultural bias and cultural norms, I think, can be positive in many ways. So one thing I mentioned in my talk was as data scientists and practitioners in this space, having sort of a bias towards skepticism and curiosity about data, about methods that we're using and the models we're using, always asking why something is working the way it is. I think that is all good and ensures that we're producing high quality results and also being transparent and fully understanding sort of what these analytics and models are doing.
All right. So we can call that the grain of salt bias, correct?
Yeah, that's a great expression for it. Yep.
You discuss in your presentation how organizations tend to use found data, existing data that they already have lying around on the servers. This is true of all organizations, collect lots of data for lots of reasons, and they may repurpose existing data to answer questions about something like insider threat. And on the one hand, it's efficient and it's cost-effective to use what you have. But on the other hand, an organization may miss something when data collection is not geared toward a specific question or issue, kind of the garbage in, garbage out term. How have you seen this play out?
Yeah, this is a really common problem in data science. It's something I encounter all the time across organizations and sectors where I've worked. The issue being is, especially in larger organizations, right? You may get a data set, and it's very rare that you, with that data set, comes a full understanding of why the data was collected, how the data was collected, you know, what population the data actually describes, what population the data was supposed to describe, what the data generation process is. You know, all those are usually questions that you have to ask. And often there aren't answers because, like you mentioned, often we're just taking data that's been collected for another purpose, say for a payroll system or for an HR system, and using that data and trying to figure out if there's any value that we can get out of that. A couple more concrete examples of this, sort of speaking first about the data generation process. When you get a data set, and especially if it's a large data set, there's a tendency that's very natural to think, oh, this must be, if it's not a description of the total population, then, you know, surely it's like some sort of random sample of the population. And as statisticians and data scientists, we think, oh, it's okay then if it's a random sample. But in many cases, it may not be, right? And so one example I've used here is you could think about like maybe getting a data set that describes, you know, outcomes of performance evaluations or performance improvement plans for employees. And so that data set may say stuff about the employee and like what was in their performance improvement plan and how long they were engaged in that process and like then whether they left the organization or not. And so with that data, you could be tempted to build a model that sort of describes churn, right? Describes the effectiveness of those improvement plans. However, if that data set was generated only from folks who, you know, say performance improvement plans are only creative for employees if they've already been flagged as being underperforming in their jobs, right? So that's a small subsample of the population, a specific subsample of the population. So if you wanted to then apply the results of those models to the whole population of the workforce, it's not going to work well at all. So that's one example. And then kind of digging a little bit further into this problem, if you look within a data set, anyone who works with data knows that data is messy. And one thing you have to deal with all the time is missing data, right? So you may have a big data set and you find one variable in that data set, one column that seems to perfectly describe the thing that you're interested in. You know, maybe that's employee satisfaction. You know, maybe it's performance score of some kind, whatever the case may be. But you notice that there's only a value there for 10% of the population of your data set, right? Or maybe even less sometimes. And so then you have to ask, what does the missingness in that 90% of the remaining records in the data, what does that actually say? Does that mean we actually don't know? Is there an implied value there that you don't understand? And so that's where you can get into a real rabbit hole of kind of chasing your tail of like, what does that missingness mean and trying to mitigate it when, again, often you'll have no idea sort of why that data is missing in the first place. And so it's like you said, garbage in, garbage out is a good thing to keep in mind there for sure.
Organizational leadership is in, you know, they're always kind of struggling to be good stewards of the organizational dollar and spend where they need to, save where they can. So what do you think is a good strategy for organizations to save money by leveraging existing information, but spend money to collect new data?
Yeah, I think just keeping an awareness of this problem is really important. An awareness sort of that it is a problem and that found data always needs to be questioned and analyzed very carefully. I think that is maybe the number one thing to help mitigate some of these challenges. Another place where potentially, you know, organizations could spend a little bit of money to bring a big value is really investing in organizational knowledge about these sort of administrative or found data sets that reside on their servers that weren't collected for analytical purposes might actually bring a lot of value if they're well understood. And that takes time, right? Like you have to bring together all kinds of stakeholders, subject matter experts, data scientists, people who actually generate the data, people across the organization to kind of work together to build a shared understanding of what that data set is, how it was made, and what it can actually be used for and be used in a responsible way. So all that takes time, but I think making an investment there and sort of that exploratory data analysis and preserving that, I think that can go a long way for sure.
I think too, we had kind of had talked in an earlier conversation about how organizations are living things. They expand and they shrink. They purchase other organizations where they maybe purchase themselves and need to merge their systems with another entity. Organizations may also change the ways that they collect data for a variety of reasons. Perhaps that is prompted by technological changes, or they may have a desire to improve their processes. So I think you've mentioned some things that organizations can take to create better measurement, analysis, and knowledge systems by sort of investing in a data manager or a data steward or a data concierge, kind of whatever the term of choice is. Are there things that organizations can think about in order to create and maintain better management, better measurement, analysis, and knowledge systems?
Sure. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head talking about making the investment in a data steward or a data concierge. One thing that we talk a lot about in my field is data provenance. So sort of that process of tracking where the data comes from, how it's collected, how it can be used responsibly, and how it shouldn't be used, right? All those little tidbits that people will discover as they use the data, interact with the data, and things like that. You know, all that needs to be persisted in some way. And I think organizations looking out into the future can, you know, should keep an eye on that sort of thing and think about how are we not only going to preserve data, the raw data itself, but also that data provenance, all those tidbits of information that can often take a long time for folks to figure out and sometimes painfully, but can be forgotten about really rapidly, right? Like somebody leaves the organization, they didn't document something, and then maybe that knowledge is gone from the organization. So I think keeping an eye on that, setting up both sort of data capture systems, but also knowledge capture systems and knowledge management systems, I think, you know, those are some great steps that organizations can take.
I think we talked about the terms data manager, data steward, data concierge, really. And I think organizations need to realize that this can't just be the one person. The organization may be very, very large and require several people, I think, or a group of people to do this. And even if the organization is small and they just have one person, it's really important to have succession plans or have backups. So should that one person leave, there's somebody else that has that knowledge and sort of can maintain that thread as the organization changes, as they all do.
Yeah. Another thing that I find really exciting is, you know, sort of movements towards, I think the term is like data literacy. And, you know, how I would describe that is trends for organizations to record, encourage their entire workforce, everybody, to be thinking about data in this way, like the use of data in analytics and how we can, how organizations can use data, found data, things like that. I mean, I think that kind of speaks to this, right? Like it doesn't have to be like one person or, you know, six people over in the data provenance department that take care of this. It can really be a collective effort because people coming at it from different angles, different stakeholders, you know, bring a different perspective, and often bringing those different perspectives can be super helpful because it, to bring us back to, you know, what I'm supposed to be talking about, right? Like different sets of people and different individuals have different biases, right? And often those are uncovered or surfaced when someone from the outside looking in says, hey, what about this? Or, hey, that seems odd, don't you think? And often it's those kind of conversations that can bring to light an implicit bias in how you're handling data or a situation.
Cool. So I think essentially what we're saying is that all organizations should have a data task force with a cross section of employees from all sorts of different groups that can be there to kind of help curate and document data sets and then perhaps even educate the rest of the organization on all of these exciting things.
Absolutely. I mean, I coming from a data scientist as myself, that sounds super exciting. I hope it sounds exciting to everybody.
Okay. Well, I'm excited. So I think everyone else should be.
Great.
So one of the things I do want to ask about is something that your organization does. Elder Research's Risk 360 model empowers insider threat analysts through data fusion and prioritization. And you and your company transform multiple data sources into models and alerts. And in doing so, you create lots of effective and engaging user interfaces and visualizations for the analyst. Data visualization has been a hot topic for several years now. What are some of the most effective visualizations that you found that you can really use to engage folks in the security and workforce protection space?
Sure. What we think about most often with respect to visualization, I guess a couple things. One is at the end of the day, we're really there to serve our customers, serve the analysts who are actually using this data to do their job on a day-to-day basis. So really a core part of our workflow is a very iterative and back and forth process with those individuals, with security and counterintelligence and counter-insider threat professionals. You know, we'll produce prototypes, you know, bring it to them and just ask, like, you know, is this useful to you, right? Like, we don't want to be dictating, like, here's the visualization you must use because, you know, Adam Trexler said it's the best. Like, we want something that's going to actually help people do their job more efficiently. So I think that's maybe one of our guiding principles when it comes to visualization. With respect to insider threat and going back to something I talked about earlier, I think analyzing individuals and visualizing, you know, individuals or cases relative to their context here is really important. As I'm sure most folks listening to this are, you know, well aware of, insider threat, I mean, it's hard to define and it's much, much harder to measure, right? It would be great if we could sit down and build a single model that, you know, kind of worked across organizations and across different types of people in different stages of their career. And, you know, the model says, here's a person that's a number five. That means they, whatever. right? Like that, but that's not how it works at all, right? You always have to look at people relative to where they're in the career, where they're in the organization, and things like that, like we talked about earlier. So the types of visualizations that we tend to use really highlight that fact. And so both in terms of the types of modeling approaches we take, so we often will do things instead of producing just a number, which is alone is kind of meaningless, we'll use that number to rank or prioritize cases or individuals for analysts to look at. And so, you know, using visualizations that do that, that sort of prioritize risks, I think is really important. And then kind of looking at individuals, I think what is often helpful too is creating visualizations that let you look at an individual's risk relative to their career, relative to their timeline within the organization. So letting analysts sort of longitudinally track how someone's risk level or stress level or whatever it is that you're trying to analyze, let them track that longitudinally through time to see, okay, how is that individual's risk seeming to change over time? Because again, context is important here. You know, someone may enter an organization and for whatever reason, they produce a high score in whatever analytic it is that you're using. If that score sort of stays high for years and years and sort of never changes and that person, nothing concerning happening, that's a useful piece of information for the analyst to have, right? But I think it's sort of the relative change in risk or score or whatever, I think ends up being a much more powerful tool to help the analysts do their jobs.
So essentially, I think not only the numbers are important, but sort of the story and the interpretation I think behind all of those numbers are important to either understand groups of people or sometimes just the individual, I think, as they move through an organization or move through their career.
Absolutely. Yep.
All right. Well, Adam, we have been talking about lots and lots of stuff, I think, in regard to data and bias, and I think how that plays out in insider threat and applies to workforce protection. Well, thank you all for listening, and a big thank you to our speaker, Dr. Adam Trexler. As I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, to listen to Dr. Trexler's summit presentation, please visit sbssummit.com. Also, don't miss out on new products from the Threat Lab. You may sign up for our distribution list at, I'm going to spell this out, dodhra.threatlab@mail.mil.